Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon. You tell me. You call home. Je ne comprends pas. Je ne comprends rien de ça.
Welcome to Science News You Can Use Radio with Amy Alcon and Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm science-based advice columnist and author Amy Alcon, also known as the Advice Goddess.
And I'm the animal behaviorist and author Dr. Jennifer Vertelin, or Jungle Jen, as Amy likes to call me.
This is our every other week show on which we lay out science news you can use to solve your relationship problems or just improve your relationships and have a better life. And not to worry, I will still be doing shows on the best behavioral science books and authors on the weeks in between.
Tonight's show is about whether being opposites is really a good predictor for a successful relationship, whether it's the classic Harry met Sally, or as good as it gets, where the anxiety-riddled Jack Nicholson sets off into the sunset with the calm and collected Helen Hunt, Hollywood would have us believe that clashing personality types make for the best soulmate. And that would really be like a cat and a dog trying to have a romantic relationship. Well, for anyone that's convinced that birds of a feather make for strange bedfellows, stick with us to learn how science weighs in on matchmaking when it comes to friends and lovers. Okay, so Amy, I mentioned how Hollywood has tried to convince us that we are really better off with opposites. But I was wondering what your perspective is on this.
Well, people think they want opposites. It makes for a far better chick flick. But without conflict, you know, a chick flick is without, like, my dad snoring, you know, for an hour and a half. It also sounds sexier. It's more exotic, you know, and it really is exciting to have somebody exotic to you. He's going to hate this, but my boyfriend, he's very exotic to me. So he's Catholic and from Detroit like me, but, you know, his school, Bishop Gallagher, I'd hear it on the radio, you know, announcing snow days, and it was just a world away. And I was raised Jewish. I'm an atheist, but I was raised to marry somebody Jewish and, you know, just to have a certain path. And so, you know, this is sort of the exotic path. But the thing is, he and I are actually alike in meaningful ways, you know, in bad and good. He's messy. I'm messy. So he comes over to my house. I'm horrified sometimes by just piles of paper and everything. And he thinks it's cute, which is just, it's amazing to me. He must be lying, but he insists he's not. We're both entrepreneurs. We created our own careers. We're curious. We're not PC. We both laugh at things that people would think are horrible. So on all these levels, we mesh. So we're not going out to a restaurant and he's pointing something out and I'm horrified. I'm just laughing. So it works.
Right. Well, you know, and it's interesting because even though we're given this message, you know, like you're pointing out that you have a lot of similarities that are really important with your mate, you know, when it comes to animals, the only place where we really see differences or where opposites are the best match, and even in humans at a physical level, is when it comes to these things called MHC for short, or major histocompatibility complex genes for a mouthful. And these genes are involved in how we fight disease and in supporting our immune system. And so in animals, the real way that we see opposites attracting, like a lemur, for example, which is a small nocturnal persimmon that's found in Madagascar, they actually choose their mates based on how opposite they are on these particular genes.
Well, they're not running genetic tests. How do they know if their MHC genes are different?
Well, us and all other animals that use this as a marker for attracting a mate, they do it based on smell. So those wonderful, sexy things called pheromones that we always hear about, those elusive hormones that we supposedly can smell. So in mouse lemurs in particular, they actually use their sense of smell to sniff out the most opposite mate to them on these particular genes.
But they're not thinking about that. They just think, boy, you smell good.
Well, you're right. And it's same for us. So they've done some studies with humans that show that as long as the woman's not on birth control, she will sniff out a male that's most opposite to her on these MHC genes.
Yeah, you brought up a good point with birth control. This is really horrible. And not a lot of people know this, that birth control, yeah. when women are on the pill, it changes what kind of mm-hmm. smelling person they're smelling man usually. Sometimes I'm not sure how it works with lesbians, but with heterosexual relationships, the smell of the man they'd be attracted to. So if you're on the pill, you find a boyfriend and you go off the pill, he might not smell good to you anymore. And people need to realize that.
Well, right. And you know, one of the reasons why these MHC, the opposites attracting at the MHC genes is so important is because the offspring of these couples will have the best sort of mishmash and mix of genes available, getting one set from their mom and one set from their dad, so that they would actually be in the best position to fight diseases and have a stronger immune system.
That's a great point. I always thought about that as soon as I learned about this and wondered if it's why I've never been attracted to blondes or redheads. I always thought, you know, I mean, I've met some redheaded guys and I thought, oh, it'd be so cute. We'd look like brother and sister. I don't know why I didn't think, ooh, incest. And I thought that would be cute. But I wasn't actually ever really attracted to any of them. And, you know, who knows? Do redheads all have the same? Do we stink the same? I'm not sure. But it's an interesting thing if you look at the type of people you're attracted to, if there are any similarities. I mean, that's just something speculative on my part, of course.
Well, but, you know, and actually you might be onto something, but it might have less to do with these MHC genes and more to do with liking your men to be a little bit more opposite to you in the testosterone load department, because there's pretty good evidence that males, that black and brown hair actually contain more of the melanin that is produced by heavier testosterone loads. And so you're kind of like a female lion because they prefer their dark-haired males over blondies, too.
Yeah, you know, so I like that. I'm more like a female lion. And now, you know, there are sex differences. And one of the things that really bothers me about modern feminism, all for women having the vote, equal pay, if you're doing the same job, working on the oil rig, you get the same, you know, whatever an hour. But the denial that we are different, the notion that we're all the same, you know, we have these very pronounced sex differences. And they're pronounced, even our body shape, you can tell from far away if it's a man or a woman, because a woman will have the hourglass figure or something close to it. Mm-hmm. And men, the men that women tend to prefer are, number one, tall. We don't care as much about looks as men do. They prioritize it more because it tells you if a woman's fertile, all the stuff we consider beauty. But women prefer, they prioritize men who are tall in that V shape. So the small waist, the big shoulders, that V-shaped chest in a man. But mm-hmm. but again, there are nuances based on, for example, are you ovulating? Are you looking for a short-term or long-term
right.
mate? Because that depends. You're talking about testosterone before, whether you want the testosterone profile of a dad or a cad, as it said.
Right. Well, and, you know, I'm like you. I actually prefer dark-haired males over blondes, too. But I also have always preferred sort of taller and seemingly stronger men relative to myself. And, you know, it's funny because when we look at animals, we see in monogamous pairs, usually they actually are more attracted to individuals that are more similar in size and physical traits to themselves. But female hawks are kind of the exception, and they go the other way. They actually prefer males that are a little bit smaller to them.
So wait, why are these female hawks, why are they going for the teeny weenies?
Well, so it's a very practical reason, really. The female, when she's sitting on the eggs, is relying on the male to go get her food. And male hawks that are smaller weigh less, which, you know, even a small amount of a half a pound or a quarter of a pound difference is enough to make a male hawk faster and catch more food.
Oh, that's you'd think that it would be the other way around, that the bigger ones would do that. And you say that barnacle geese, that they like a mate that's similar size. Why would they? This is all adaptive to the environment, right?
Well, yeah. And so usually when you look at monogamous pair bonds in animals, you really can't tell who's the male and who's the female. And I mean, even in hawks, it's a very subtle difference. Like, we wouldn't be able to tell by looking at them. But for barnacle geese, they're choosing individuals that are similar size. They seem to do better and reproduce better together. And it might just have to do with something. They're just better physically matched. I'm not sure that anybody knows the reason why, but they do see that individuals will prefer a mate that's more similar in size to them. But there are always these exceptions, you know. So, but, you know, well, I wanted to go back for – oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I wanted to go back to what you said about at the beginning about similarities between you and Greg. And I was wondering if you would consider these things personality traits more than, you know, just liking him because he has darker hair.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question because this is what the research shows. So people believe, because I think they think it makes them sound more interesting, that they want someone opposite to them, someone exotic, but they actually don't. What people seem to want to go for is shared personality traits. So, mm-hmm. you know, and what I think is important, you can describe, okay, someone's meticulous or they're laid back. You know, if a person, as I was saying before, a laid back person with somebody who is a high strung nut job, sometimes they can, you know, mediate that, but sometimes it's very stressful for both because they're wanting different things out of their environment. And what I think right. is essential is to look to what actually is essential to you. So the things that drive who you are and how you respond on a daily basis. So the laid back thing, are you going to hate them for it? You know, And it's important also to do things like camping or hiking or building something together, you know, where you can
oh, yeah.
see people at their worst. People always think, oh, you know, I want to focus on how he's, you know, good in bed and funny and everything like that. But, you know, nobody breaks up with somebody because they're funny and great in bed. So it, you really right. have to get them in those stress situations. So if somebody's an asshole, that'll come out.
Well, so, and, you know, it's interesting because I have a friend of mine who went on a 3-month hike with her fiance, and that 3-month hike along the Pacific Coast Trail by themselves was going to determine whether or not they got married. So if they came out of the woods alive and not hating each other, then they would get married. And I think, I mean, that's a little on the extreme, right? I mean, maybe just putting together some IKEA furniture would be a good thing to try.
Yeah, right. So what
you know,
happened?
But that, well, they got married. They got married, and they've been married for, I don't know, like 12 years, and are just a really, you know, one can never tell by looking on the outside, but they seem really happy and cooperate well together, and are, you know, seemingly still in love. But they did. They went into the forest for 3 months. That's commitment right there.
Yeah, it sure is. Oh my God, just going to the forest for an afternoon, in my opinion. Now, when we come back, we're going to talk about whether animals make choices based on similarities and personalities. But first, you're listening to Science News You Can Use Radio with Amy Alcon and Dr. Jennifer Vertelin.
And don't forget to support our show and entertain yourself while improving your life and by buying our new books.
And I'm Amy Alcon, and my book is Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck because I'm a bad person. And
and I'm Dr. Jennifer Vertelin, and my book is Wild Connection, What Animal Courtship and Mating Tell Us About Human Relationships.
Okay, this is something I really want to know. Do animals make choices based in similarities and personalities?
Oh, they totally do. And it's really interesting because a lot of this work has been done in birds. And so Great Tits, which always gets whenever
wait
I talk
a second.
To students.
Yeah, wait.
I know.
My notes. It says, yes, Great Tits. And I want to say, why, thank you. Okay, so my amateur joke out of the way. Tell us about Great Tits and how they make choices based on similarities and personalities.
Well, so Great Tits, they're really, they've done a lot of stuff, experiments on personalities in Great Tits, and it turns out that the Great Tits that are the big explorers, the adventurers, if you will, really like to pair up with other Great Tits that are similarly adventurous and exploratory, more exploratory, and the couch potatoes all kind of like to hang out together. And so they do sort of separate out based on this personality. And now when it comes to something like a zebra finch, which is these
tiny
little...
Wait, can I stop you on that? I mean, how do they know where the couch potatoes are? Are they the ones sitting on the wire eating a can of Pringles? How do you spot them if you're a Great Tit?
Well, so a lot of times it's how far you will explore out of your territory for food, how quickly you'll go investigate a novel object. Now, and this is the way that researchers have tested the different personalities. So I don't know if they know quite how, let's say, a female Great Tit is determining the personality of the male that she might be choosing to make a nest with that year. I don't know if they figured that out, but they have figured out the different personalities of the different birds, and they pair up according accordingly. So I don't
Oh, sorry. I was just going to add something about humans. No, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, no. It's fine. I mean, I don't know that there's any Pringles out there for them to sit on the couch with, but they certainly are assorting that way based on their personalities.
And so this is kind of similar to humans. If you know, the way you describe this, that the ones that are the adventurers versus the couch potatoes, there are people, you know, who will go try weird foods and everything. My friends tried this with me. I was not really freaked out or anything. In Italy in the 90s, they took me to a restaurant and I didn't know what anything was. And so we got it was quite good. And then Tomas, my friend, said, "Oh, that's cowtail." And I was under horrified. He was very disappointed. So, you know, I'm not the person, I won't eat bugs, you know, I'm not going to eat a cricket, but I'll eat, you know, most things. And kind of like that in France when I'm too tired to figure out the menu. So somebody who's going to be comfortable with me is going to be somebody who doesn't need to go to, you know, the Kraft macaroni and cheese dinner or whatever it is that people eat that's really bland. And I mean, that's just a small example on the food scale, but like camping and everything, if you like camping, I'm not your girl.
Right.
So,
right. Well, and if my best friend, she won't go anywhere if she can't plug something in like a hairdryer, like, you know, that's just a requirement. And so, yeah. And I think that we don't think about the way these personality differences really affect your day-to-day life.
Yeah, it's very important. And another thing that's very important is actually how inspired you are by your partner. And I call this having a crush on a partner as a human being. And what this means is that you have this deep respect, you know, and even admiration for who the person is, how he goes about life. Because what happens is as you get into a relationship, especially if you live together, which I personally don't advise, I don't have kids, so that's a little easier, but, you know, the person you're with, they will do things that would annoy a Buddhist monk, the kind of guy who, like, his afternoon adventure is relaxing and seeing the fire ants and showing how calm he is. You know, and if you have a hot for somebody, you know, all around, not just physically, but as a human being, you are less likely to, you know, to dream of things. To the things that you do with them, they're less likely to involve strangling or blunt force trauma.
Well, right, because, I mean, I think, you know, if you don't have any kind of respect for the person as a human being, and you're going to end up not being able to survive the kind of conflicts that might arise from some small personality differences that can get magnified, right, in the face of lack of respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's important to remember, too, is that what you respect and admire in another person comes out of who you are. So go back to that thing of, like attracts like. It's who you are, what you value. So you can have differences. You don't have to like all the same things. Greg and I, for example, he likes this just horrible music that I would just kill myself listening to. Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima. Doesn't that sound entertaining? I listen to I'm just too embarrassed to say, but it's a lot lighter than that. So, you know, you can have differences. If you're excited about who they are, what they believe, and how they live, you know, this is okay. And the people who make a mistake are those who they talk about how tolerant they are and they think casting a wide net is a great idea. And yeah, it is. If you're one of those, you know, people that describe in personals as, you know, it's like, you know, I enjoy fine wine, you know, great food and great conversation. You know, it's like, are there five people on the planet who don't enjoy that?
Right. Well, you know, I really like what you said, that actually what you respect and admire in another person comes out of who you are and what you value, because, you know, there's really been some studies that are starting to show that married couples tend to be more similar to each other on a lot of traits. And in fact, one recent study that was done in a rural Senegalese village, they found that people actually chose to marry someone who was as cooperative and helpful to others as they themselves were.
That's very interesting, because I can see that would be an area where you'd have some conflicts and you're going to admire someone who does this. You know, another important thing, too, is to influence each other, to allow influence. And this is a word that John Gottman uses, the marriage research. And I think it's a really important word to take in stuff that somebody tells you, because they're going to be working in an interdependent way with you and have ideas about your life, especially if they admire you, which should be a criteria for getting together with someone, that they're going to try to look to improve your life. So that's a pretty important thing.
Right. I agree. And I think that, you know, sometimes though, like whether you are cooperative or helpful might even have to do with where or how you were raised. And that's when we start to get into sort of, you know, cultural differences between individuals that might come from different ethnic backgrounds or different areas.
That's a great subject. So give us an example of cultural differences, cultural clashes from the human kingdom, and then from our friends in the animal kingdom.
Well, you know, we could choose one that would be similar for both. So, you know, something like how we communicate and convey information, you know, sort of use our language. You know, some cultures really have a strong aversion towards looking at each other in the eyes when you're talking, and they kind of look downward. And in other cultures, this would be insulting, and you would think that the person is trying to communicate some kind of hostility or some sort of deception because they won't look you in the eye, right? And one of the ways we see this happen in animals is, killer whales. You have different populations that live in different areas, and they have their own sort of cultural practices in what foods they eat, how they hunt that food, and also how they communicate. They actually have different dialects. And so a whale from group A who lives over here won't even understand what a whale from that other population living somewhere else is even trying to say, even though they're the same species.
So I want to know a little bit, too, about conflict resolution. How do killer whales, for example, I mean, I can't see them, they don't go litigate it in court. How do they resolve conflicts, or how do other animals? Maybe there's another more interesting example.
Well, you know, so some of the time they resolve sort of these kinds of clashes by actually adopting the practices or behaviors of the individual or group that they're trying to get into. So, for example, chimpanzees, you know, it's well known that different populations that live in different areas have all kinds of cultural differences. They some places they hunt for termites using a stick. Other places they learn how to crack nuts with a stone. And in one population they have adopted this really strange way of grooming armpits. So now grooming armpits for chimpanzees is not strange, but the way these chimps do it is they actually hold hands and raise their hands up and then groom each other's armpits. And when a new chimp comes into this sort of population, they don't know this. They have not learned this. And what they do is they automatically sort of adopt the traditions and behaviors so that they don't have these kinds of conflicts. And you know, I mean, I think nothing sells welcome to the family like a little armpit grooming.
Yeah, that's what my family does at all holidays. we'll be there soon. We're going to do that. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about managing differences in humans. And what people don't realize in relationships, that some disagreements just can't be solved. And what's really important, you know, people say, oh, you know, winning isn't everything. Well, in a relationship, it really, really isn't everything. And my joke that I made recently in a column is having a difference of opinion without trying to do to your partner what Hitler did to Poland, that's everything. Right. You know, and a big part of this, you have to realize differences, they're unsolvable problems. And what people have to do, because you may not solve them, you have to accept that. So, but what you do to deal with some kind of difference, what people don't do, they just fly off the handle. They need to actually get into the feelings behind what the other person wants, that they need to ask the person, why do you want that? Lay out the emotions behind that. And so you still may not agree with them. You still may not be moved, but it allows you to be moved by each other's fears or distress, and so then you can act compassionately and more constructively. And in this question that I did, it was a guy telling a woman, you have to go to church with my family. She's an atheist. You know, if he instead says something like, I just want my family to like you, you know, this sounds more like something he's trying to do for her rather than to her, which allows her to respond lovingly. So I don't know if animals can do this kind of sophisticated, how sophisticated are animals in difference resolution?
Well, you know, I think it's a little hard to tell because we're not able to necessarily understand what they're conflicting over. The things that they do conflict over, you know, whether it's not understanding each other's communication or, you know, conflicting over access to resources. They definitely have a lot of different ways of going about dealing with it. And it's hard for us to make these sort of analogies, but we have seen, like in elephants, they're probably the most well-known for sort of compassionate intervention, if you will, you know, in trying to settle disputes even between two other individuals. Like somebody might get in the middle and sort of be like, okay, calm down, like act as a mediator and try to bridge the gap, you know, between conflict between two other individuals. And I think that, you know, the great thing about being human is that, you know, we supposedly can be a bit more self-reflective of our own behaviors and try to, you know, to resolve these conflicts. But like you said, I think sometimes, you know, with the whales, with the killer whales, it's not resolvable. The fact that they speak different dialects, it's just not a resolvable problem. You know, for an individual to not have conflict because they can't understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, and we often, with our fast and slow thinking systems, the way our feeling, intuitive feeling system takes off and the rational system is far behind, you know, it's often a problem for us. And we'll talk more,
right.
I want to talk more about being flexible about each other's inflexibilities. But first, you are listening to Science News You Can Use Radio with Amy Elkon and Dr. Jennifer Vertelin.
And don't forget to support our show and entertain yourself while improving your life by buying our books.
I'm Amy Elkon, and I'm the author of Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck.
And I'm Dr. Jennifer Vertelin, and my book is Wild Connection, What Animal Courtship and Mating Tell Us About Human Relationships.
Okay, so being flexible about each other's inflexibilities, what that means is that we can be flexible about some things and some things we can't. So we have personality differences. You know, we're going to have that with just about anybody. And how do you manage them? So where Greg and I are not similar is that he is an introvert and I am an extrovert, probably plus. So we have clashes in this area. His joke is that I'm so extroverted I could do 20 minutes with a parking meter. And in fact, I have to tell this story. We were in Trader Joe's and he told me to hurry and don't talk to anyone, which he says, and he knows it's totally futile. And I laugh when he says that. And so he passes the aisle. I'm looking toward him and he is going by his cart at the end of the aisle just as I'm hugging the manager. And he just shook his head because that's so me. And at Greg, on the other hand, my joke about Greg is that his favorite kind of party is one that's canceled. So, but the upshot of that is knowing that I'm able to talk to strangers just about everywhere and I love it and it's fine. So if there's a party I don't really need him to go to, if I think, oh, he's going to just really be bored there, I try to have him stay home. Sometimes he doesn't want me to drive to some terrible place by myself, but, you know, I just don't want to see, like, you know, bored boyfriend face. And
right.
That's that thing of mediating what I want versus what's good for him. That's that thing in a relationship that's so important where you're interdependent and you're looking out for the good of both of you and not just, here's what I want right now.
Right. Well, but okay, but do you think that overall the places where you are similar help you manage better those areas where you're different?
That's a very good question. Absolutely, because there's a wellspring of good feeling when you
right.
When you're similar. Basically, you're looking in the mirror, and to some extent, that person's echoing things you find important, like your kind of ethics and your humor and all these other things. So I do think that similarity helps keep relationships happy because it balances those things that don't quite work, that you look at that person, you think that they're sexy and adorable. And by the way, we did skip something I wanted to know about. It was like cockatiel sex. I don't know if that's an appropriate time for that.
Well, for animals, they don't just make their choices based on personality similarities, but, you know, there's other things that you kind of need to be compatible and similar on. And this is actually an argument that a lot of people have in their relationships, right? About, you know, sort of sex, how much you want sex. And if you're a cockatiel, that crush you have on your partner better include sexual compatibility, because if the partner isn't as responsive to your needs as you want, they find a new mate. And so, you know, I think life can get in the way, you know, but if people start on wildly different ends of the spectrum when it comes to how important sex is to them, this is going to be a conflict for sure.
And then there are moral conflicts. And we're almost out of time, but I really want to hear this story. You went out with a guy who actually, out he did something horrible, you know, especially if you're an animal behaviorist, you know. So tell us about this guy.
Well, right. So this goes back to, like, I couldn't be flexible about this person's, you know, sort of ethics or values. So I was on a date. It was the first date, so I had no way of knowing this information. And he was like, yeah, I really love animals. You know, I used to fight dogs. And it took a lot for me not to, you know, really get hostile. But then he was like, I don't do it anymore.
Club him with a breadstick, you know? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was so speechless that, like, that he would actually tell me that, which, you know, just showed me he really didn't have any clue about, you know, what it really meant to love animals. Like, we had very different definitions of what it meant to love and value animals. And that was just, even if he didn't do it anymore, it didn't matter, because the fact that he used to do it told me something very significant about his values.
Oh, my God, yeah. It's not like, oh, I'm a different person. That was 3 years ago. Oh, my God, that's just horrible. You know, and that's...
And I could really infect somebody.
Yeah, and that's essential. Yeah. You know, contempt for somebody, I would feel contempt for someone who did that, is a killer of relationships, and you have to respect somebody at the core. Contempt, you know, it's expressed in disgust, and Gottman, who I mentioned before, John Gottman, the marriage researcher, he finds that, I think it's like the top killer of relationships. Once he hears contempt, people talking to each other with contempt, he thinks, like, oh, it's done, you're getting divorced. You know, I don't know if it's possible to save that. I don't really think it is.
I don't think so either. And I think it even applies to friendships, you know, because I think we are friends with people who are similar to us as well. And you have the same thing play out where if you can't respect somebody, you can't be their friend or their lover. I mean, it's just not possible.
Yeah, I think that that's an important point, you know, that these friendships, you mentioned that when we were talking before the show, that we drift apart from friends and loved ones because people change and new differences arise. And you tell a story about that with a chimp and a baboon, how they sort of fell apart.
Yeah, so, and you know, it's really kind of interesting because, you know, this would be, talk about opposites attracting. I mean, a chimpanzee and a baboon becoming friends, that's kind of out there. But in fact, in the Gombe forest in Africa, chimpanzees and baboons regularly interact with each other, but because they play differently, this usually leads to conflict. And there was this one chimpanzee, young female, and she didn't have any friends her age. And she struck up a friendship with a little baboon. And for about a year, they played and laughed and tickled each other, and there was really no problem. And then the young chimp had to leave with her mom to go to a new area for about 6 months. And when she came back, the baboon female had really sort of grown up and was now playing more differently. And these differences made it impossible for their friendship to sort of revive itself, and they had to go their separate ways.
That's sad. It's like kids who move. That's very sad. Now we are almost at the end of our show. This is Amy Elkon, and you've been listening to Science News You Can Use Radio with Amy Elkon and Dr. Jennifer Vertelin.
Support our show and entertain yourself while improving your life by buying our new books.
And my book is Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck. I'm Amy Elkon. And Dr. Jennifer Vertelin's book is Wild Connection, What Animal Courtship and Mating Tell Us About Human Relationships. So, Dr. Jen, any final words from the animal kingdom?
Well, you know, I think that because these differences can arise in our relationships and our friendships, we could take a little bit of advice from the French angelfish. And when they, to keep their relationship new and fresh and kind of stay on the same page with one another, they engage in all kinds of new and exciting behaviors. When they meet up, they twirl around each other and carousel around each other. And so they're always trying to make sure they are on the same page with one another. And I think that that is something we can try to do to keep our relationships lasting longer.